VOA Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Derek Chollet. He's former senior Obama administration official who served in the White House, State Department, and the Pentagon, most recently as Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. He's the author of a new book about President Obama's foreign policy legacy, The Long Game, How Obama Defied Washington and Redefined America's Role in the World. Currently, Chollet is counselor and senior advisor for security and defense policy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. The book is written from an insider's perspective. Chollet argues that President Obama has profoundly altered the course of American foreign policy for the better. He takes readers behind the scenes of intense struggles over such consequential issues as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the meltdown of Syria and the rise of the so-called Islamic State or ISIL, the Ukraine crisis and a belligerent Russia under Vladimir Putin, the conflict in Libya, the Iran nuclear deal, and the rise of China. Chollet argues that despite several policy mistakes, President Obama was mostly right on issues that matter for the so-called long game, how and where America uses military force, how the U.S. approaches its enemies and works with its partners, and how America should conceive of its power and exert its leadership. But with the Middle East in turmoil, Europe facing its greatest test since the end of the Cold War, a resurgent Russia, the rise of Islamist violent extremism, the near collapse of the Iraqi state, and the disintegration of Syria, many Obama supporters and detractors are questioning whether the Obama administration has done enough to mitigate, in part, some of these crises. Well, Derek Chollet joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his new book, The Long Game, How Obama Defied Washington and Redefined America's Role in the World. Derek Chollet, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And as always, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Jeff Selden.
Glad to be here.
Well, Derek Chollet, congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
And as I alluded to in my introduction, many supporters, as well as detractors of President Obama, have some questions about the way President Obama has conducted foreign policy, particularly in his second term. Why do you argue that President Obama has profoundly altered the course of American foreign policy for the better and positioned the United States to actually lead into the future?
Sure. Well, Carol, first, thanks for having me here and for having the opportunity to talk about the book. There are two kinds of Washington books, typically. One is the kind of book that a former official leaves government and writes a book about how all of their former colleagues screwed everything up, and if they had only been listened to, that things would be much better. Second kind of book is one that tries to place the author in the middle of every important event that has occurred in the administration. So in this book, The Long Game, I try to break that mold in that I am, of course, drawing on my experiences and bringing people inside the room, at the White House Situation Room, inside the Pentagon, as we've grappled with many of these challenges, and you listed many of them in your introduction, around the world. But at the same time, tried to put the United States on the course to implement a long-term strategy to ensure the U.S. leadership and strength can be preserved and, in fact, enhanced in the 21st century. And so The Long Game, the title, has a double meaning. One meaning is I contend in this book that President Obama has played what I call a long game, that he has a grand strategy that he has been trying to implement over 8 years, and that one of the stories of his administration and his presidency has been the struggle between trying to implement that strategy and putting America on a path for success in the future while grappling with all of these issues that have been popping up around the world that have been the subject of many of your shows, whether it's what's happening in the Middle East or what's happening in Asia Pacific or in Europe. There has been no shortage of crises under the course of this administration, and so there will be a debate on how it has handled them. And that leads me to the second meaning of the title, The Long Game. I contend in this book that in history's long game, President Obama and his administration will be remembered as a pivotal administration for turning America around and putting us on a path for success in the future. I understand that that can be a hard verdict to accept today when the news is dominated by so many crises, But it seems to me the question is less about is the world complicated, because in many instances the world's always complicated and we can sort of pick any moment in history and tell a story about how there are all these things happening beyond our control. The question in my mind is what position are we in to do something? And you use the phrase do more. And that's one of the questions is what more can we do and what more should we do? And particularly when these problems around the world, many of them are not about the United States. I mean, the United States has many tools to bring to try to shape outcomes, but what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening in Europe, even in many ways what's happening in the Asia Pacific in terms of the shifting power dynamics there is not about U.S. actions. These are deeper phenomenon underway. And so the struggle for the Obama administration and for future administrations will figure out how the U.S. can use the tools of its influence most effectively to try to bring about the kind of change that we would like to see happen. Even though my book often gets shorthanded as a defense of the Obama administration, and certainly it is trying to make the case that Obama has been successful when many believe that he has not been successful. But at the same time, I think it's trying to explain the Obama administration. So it's not to deny that there have been challenges and some of the calls in retrospect we could have done differently. But the point is, by bringing readers into the room, trying to open up readers into the discussion that we were having around the table in the Situation Room or in the Defense Department or at the State Department, and as we struggled with these issues and the trade-offs we were making about how to use the various tools we have to try to address problems, how we got to where we are. And you may end up still disagreeing with where we ended up, but at least you have greater exposure to the logic and to the concerns and the risks we were confronting at the time.
Well, of course, President Obama was elected in 2008 and 2012 to, in some ways, extricate the United States from what many considered an overreach by the Bush administration. But very friendly critics say that perhaps he went too far in the other direction. I recall Hisham Malhem, a well-known journalist from Al Arabiya, saying, you know, in Obama's zeal to be the antithesis of George W. Bush, who is perceived to have intervened too much and perhaps on false premises with respect to Iraq, Obama didn't intervene sufficiently in limited and maybe strategic ways which could have served our values and interests, i.e. in Syria. And again, intervene doesn't mean boots on the ground, necessarily big weapon systems. What some are arguing, again, both those in the Democratic Party and, of course, some in the Republican Party, saying that we perhaps didn't seize an opportunity. So I wanted to get your view with respect to a couple of things, whether it's not finishing the job in Libya, the intervention, which was highly criticized, but which many say was a very positive thing, but just we didn't go far enough in cleaning up the, you know, the mess, removing arms from militias and so forth. And maybe with respect to Iraq, notwithstanding the agreement that we would pull the troops out in December 2011, given the agreement with Iraq, perhaps we could have made an argument to keep a contingent there. It might have forestalled the rise of ISIS or al-Qaeda.
Look, there is a myth of American disengagement, and I think it's a myth. I know, the United States is more engaged in more places, in more ways around the world than we were 8 years ago. If you look at the Asia Pacific and what we're doing there in terms of regional institutions, our leadership activities, our military footprint, it's far greater than it was 8 years ago. You look at Europe. Europe's in the middle of tremendous turmoil between what's happening with Russia to migration to Brexit. But in Europe, the United States leadership is as good as it's ever been. We're tripling U.S. defense spending in Europe. We've got U.S. forces now based in Poland and the Baltics. We are more engaged in Europe. The Middle East is the toughest set of problems. And it's true, there are not 150,000 troops in Iraq. And I think we should be careful not to judge the sole metric of U.S. engagement in the Middle East of whether we have 150,000 troops in Iraq, because I think history will basically already concluded this, but that the Iraq war, whether you support it or not, was a huge mistake for the United States strategically and also in the region. By the way, I supported the war in Iraq. And I'm willing to say that that was a mistake. And I think part of what Obama has been trying to get at is trying to learn from mistakes. And we can argue whether he's learned the right lessons. Some argue that perhaps he's overlearned lessons. But certainly when it comes to the debate about America and the Middle East, it seems to me at least, many have forgotten the lessons of Iraq. And take Libya, for example. Planning the intervention in Libya, but also the aftermath, there was no shortage of thought given to what a post-war, post-Qaddafi Libya would look like. But drawing on the lessons of Iraq, several of the conclusions we made. One, that the United States could not be in the lead on this alone. It needed to be something we needed to do with partners, and the U.S. had unique capabilities that it could bring to bear in a post-Qaddafi Libya, but it could not do this all on its own. Secondly, we really needed to empower the local indigenous forces, that ultimately this had to be Libyans' future to decide. And third, the U.S. and non-Libyans, so not just Americans, but Europeans as well, were not going to be in Libya with a heavy military footprint. And we weren't going to run the place, which is what we did in Iraq and what we did in Afghanistan. That then, therefore, by definition, limited what we could do in post-Qaddafi Libya. And I was part of this effort in the government, and we struggled to try to get the new Libyan government to agree to provide greater security for us, to agree to do some of the things that were necessary for us to give them the help that we wanted to give them. And ultimately, of course, the security situation became so dangerous that even today, we don't have an embassy in Tripoli. We had to pull out our embassy because of the security concerns there. So it also shows the limits of what the United States can do if we don't have the military footprint, if we don't have 100,000 troops there trying to run things, how it's limited in what we can do just from a practical security perspective. And this gets to Syria. I worked in the Pentagon for the last several years of my time in the administration, and I spent most of my time dealing with Syria or some issue that was related to Syria. And there was no shortage of ideas that we had in the Pentagon about ways we could use military power to try to influence the outcome on the ground. What we struggled with, though, and what the president was rightly asking us, is how we could be confident that some of the ideas we were coming up with would not lead to escalation and greater U.S. involvement that would look something more akin to Iraq. Because there's no question that if we had been responsible, been complicit in any outcome in Syria, particularly a change in regime, which is our policy, but if we had been doing that through a military means, we would be responsible for what came next. And this gets back to the long game, which is, you know, it's not as though we're doing nothing in Syria. I mean, recently, the United States hosted another counter-ISIL coalition meeting here in Washington, and that was bringing the world together to talk about how we collectively can be taking military action against ISIL and Iraq and Syria. And of course, the U.S. is doing the vast majority of the military effort there. That's not disengagement. I mean, every day since September of 2014, American pilots have been taken to the air to drop bombs in Iraq and Syria. That is not military disengagement. So now we can argue, are we hitting the right targets? Should we be dropping more bombs? Should we be having more folks on the ground doing it? And that's an honest debate. I get into a lot of that in the book. But it seems to me that's it's a different kind of engagement that Obama has been trying to implement. And arguably, it's a more diverse and sophisticated sense of engagement than just, we're going to invade countries.
I promise to give my colleague Jeff Seldon a crack at asking you a question, but I just need to follow up very quickly on Syria. And that's because it's not that critics are saying Obama is disengaged per se, but we're going back even before what you call in the book the red line incident, the red line statement where President Obama said, you know, I have a red line in Syria if Bashar al-Assad uses chemical weapons, and it's also known as the non-strike incident. But before that, even in 2012, many of President Obama's seasoned advisors and regional experts like Fred Hoff, who's now at the Atlantic Council, or Ambassador Robert Ford, who resigned in frustration, or cabinet secretaries like Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus, Leon Panetta, said well before the so-called, you know, red line statement that the United States should do more to respond to the pleas by Syrian civilian and rebel forces who were merely asking for defensive means, you know, to defend themselves against the onslaught, the brutal crackdown by Bashar al-Assad on their peaceful protests. So once again, this is easy in retrospect to analyze and to say we should have done more of this and that. But that's the perception that people were asking way before, not saying we need to get involved militarily, but, you know, to have forestalled, you know, what we're seeing today, which is a full-on civil war and, of course, the migrant crisis.
By trying to bring readers inside the room through this book, I talk about all of those issues. First, they were not as clear-cut then at the time. These were all very close colleagues of mine and still friends of mine, the folks you mentioned, and I didn't necessarily disagree with them, but we all struggled with the answer that President Obama would ask, which is, if this doesn't work, then what? Because the logic of escalation would settle in. And it would be, if we were to do one thing and it doesn't work, then we are going to be expected, don't pretend that the demand will be for us to do less. It will be for us to do more.
But then what, if I may respectfully interject, is what we're seeing now. Nonetheless, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Derek Chollet. He's a former senior Obama administration official and the author of a new book, The Long Game, How Obama Defied Washington and Redefined America's Role in the World. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Yao Asua. He's from Abidjan, Côte d'Ivoire. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now a question from Jeff.
I want to get back to the discussion about the red line because it seems in many ways there are two main types of critics of the Obama administration and its foreign policy. There are those who criticize what the president has done, and then there are also those who seem to criticize the way he does whatever he does. And a lot of that criticism has focused on the comments he made about the red line in Syria, with many arguing that because he declared there was a red line and he said this is a line that can't be crossed, but then failed to take any military action as a result, that it weakened the United States. Do you think that in any way they may have a point?
The red line is, I agree with you, probably the most iconic moment of the Obama administration, and it's certainly the source of many of the critiques. President Obama himself has said it's kind of the inverted pyramid from which everything flows from the red line. I have a very different view of that episode, and in the first chapter of my book, I talk about this in great detail because as a Pentagon official at the time that the red line was set, but then also the dramatic weeks in August and September of 2013 when we were planning for strikes, going to Congress to ask for support for those strikes, but then, of course, taking the opportunity for a diplomatic success and seizing it. I look at this very differently. I spent the better part of 2 years in the first several years of the Syria crisis extremely worried about the disposition of Syria's chemical weapons. And this is where, again, I think the history here matters very much. I mean, Syria's 1,300 tons of chemical weapons was as much as 10 times greater than the CIA wrongly estimated Iraq had in chemical weapons. And we had no military answer for it. The Israelis had no military answer for it. So we were concerned not just about the use of weapons, but actually, if you go back and look at Obama's red line statement, it's not just the use that he's talking about. It's about if the weapons were seen to be unsecured, if we were fearful that those weapons could get into the hands of extremists. So what happened with the red line was something we did not design, and it was something that was opportunistic and an improvisation. And President Obama concedes that. I concede that. But the outcome is something we never imagined possible, and maybe that's on us for not being creative enough, but thank God we achieved it, which is getting 1,300 tons of Syrian chemical weapons out of that country and destroyed. Some folks use the red line to really mean something else. I mean, the red line was really only about Syrian chemical weapons. It was not about Assad. It was not about the fundamental driver of the Syrian civil war. It was about a specific threat that we in the United States judged as the most important threat, which was the disposition of those chemical weapons.
The problem is, though, of course, with the red line is that he did go to Congress, and you say in the book, and most people acknowledge, he didn't really have to go to Congress. He had the authorization, but he chose, even against many of his advisors, to hold off and go to Congress. And of course, we know how courageous they've been over the past several years, so there was a lot of reluctance. But the other concern about the red line, Derek Chollet, is that some say that this red line actually was a so-called green light to Vladimir Putin. That is the symbolism of not making good on a very important statement that speaks to U.S. credibility, that, you know, we backed off. So that sort of signaled to Vladimir Putin that, oh, okay, well, the United States says one thing, very serious, promises something, and then there are no consequences. So I'm just going to go in and take Crimea and Ukraine again. I'm just saying these are some critics, analysts have said that this could have given the green light.
Yeah. I mean, first, this idea that there were no consequences for the red line. Assad, within the course of several weeks, admitted to a chemical weapons program that he had never before acknowledged. So what we knew about it was what we were able to glean from intelligence, and agreed to give it all up, which was the reason why he had 1,300 tons of chemical weapons was because he saw it as in his strategic advantage to have that arsenal. It was mainly about Israel, by the way. It's why he had all that. So he paid a price. And arguably he could have played less of a price if we had used military strikes to degrade 20% of his stockpile. So this idea that he got off free, I don't buy.
Again, I think it's a question of like what we did, that is the United States, either before the 2013, the red line, and then maybe afterward. It's not so much, you're right, in and of itself, it's a very good thing. But the critics are saying, you know, in addition to, you well, that's know, right. those
that,
kinds it, of
that's
things.
A different argument. That's what I'm trying to say. This is, again, why I'm trying to explain the Obama policy, but also how we think about it historically. It is, to my mind, important to disentangle those two issues. There's a red line issue about how we use military power to deal with the urgent threat of serious chemical weapons. Then there is the question of how does one use military power or diplomatic influence to try to affect the outcome of the Syrian civil war, mainly by getting rid of Assad. And that's a separate question that I get into in the book.
Is there any argument, though, to be made that, A, it was a mistake to declare a red line, and then seemingly, at least in terms of public perception, and perception so often can become reality for so many people, to not act on it? And was there even any possibility of some sort of symbolic strike to let the world know that when the U.S. says something, it means business, and then still have been able to get the negotiated settlement that took the chemical weapons out of play?
Sure, we could spin all sorts of speculations about if this had happened, then that happened, then this happened. Again, what I try to walk in the book is we were not given the luxury of just speculating. We had to, of course, assume the worst. And if this did not work, then what? You know, I think that when people look back on the Syrian conflict, for someone like myself who was involved in this policy, I don't look upon Syria today and take any solace. No one is happy with where things are. The question is, what should we do about it? And this gets back to the long game. I can give you several different things we could be doing and to quote unquote solve the Syria conflict, but that means we're not going to be doing a lot of other things, right? The narrative of this administration coming in was that the United States was overinvested in one country, Iraq. And at the expense of that investment, two countries in the world were gaining ground and were benefiting the most. One was Iran and one was China. And if the United States is trying to play a long game and we're trying to think big about our role in the world, you need to be thoughtful about how we intervene on these specific problems. That's not to say we don't do anything. No one can say that the U.S. is doing nothing. And we're more militarily engaged in different places in the Middle East than we were even 8 years ago. If we look at Syria in isolation, we can talk a lot about what the U.S. could be doing more of in Syria. The challenge for a president is how you reconcile that with everything else you're doing in the world. And so it's very easy to say from the perspective of Syria alone, here are the 10 things the United States should be doing more of. But the challenge for a president is to then reconcile that with what we're doing in the Asia Pacific, what we're doing in Europe, what we're doing elsewhere in the Middle East, also what we're doing here at home. The larger question that I get at in the long game, what is the long game? It's ensuring that the United States remains a leader in the world, not just in the military realm, but across all areas of influence and power, economic, political, diplomatic, military. It's not just one region. So rebalance is not just about rebalanced Asia. It's a balance across the places in the world that matter the most to us, the three most important, Europe, Middle East, and Asia. And I think this is where Obama, it's probably one of the more controversial parts of how he's tried to conduct foreign policy and talk about it, is he is willing to talk about limits on the United States. And that is often hard for Americans to accept, even though we all intuitively understand it. I mean, the United States has fewer limits than any country in the world. Where the policy struggles lie, and this is what I try to get at in the book, is how we take those steps, how we use those tools that we have, but in a way that's consistent with everything else we're trying to do around the world, to keep the big picture in mind.
One of the things, having talked to several senior military officials, what you hear time and time again is that with a problem like Syria, with a problem like Islamic State as it's rolling across Syria and into Iraq, is that the U.S. military, given the support, can go in there and can take them out. If there are bad guys somewhere in the world, the U.S. military officials
Absolutely.
Are confident that
Yep.
they can take it
No
out.
No question.
But the point that they always raise is the what's next.
Then what?
The
Exactly.
post-military solution. And is that the most difficult thing as part of when you talk about selling the American people on understanding limits, that the resources that were required, perhaps that were available after World War II with the Marshall Plan, the fact that the U.S. still has a presence in Germany, in Japan, in Korea, that the U.S. can't do that anymore, and therefore it makes the seductive use of military power to do something ostensibly that's good more dangerous?
You're absolutely right, and this is the question, are military leaders ask, it's the question the president asks, which is what next? Because the last thing we want to do, and we'll be confronting this in Iraq when the Iraqi forces with our support retake Mosul, is what follows that? Because what we don't want is 4 or 5 years from now, or after our attention's been elsewhere, for us to then be back in the same situation we're in today, where because of bad governance, because of lack of opportunity, because of greater sectarianism in that part of the world, we're back having to use the hammer, the U.S. military, to try to deal with a threat to us and to our partners in the region. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of good examples in recent history where our post-war efforts have worked very well. And that doesn't mean we should stop trying, but we just have to go in with a degree of humility and skepticism that that's going to be easy. And also the results, clearly, even if we have some success, the results are going to be slow in coming. So it's not going to be Germany or Japan, but certainly this administration will leave a military footprint in places like in Iraq and Afghanistan that is modest, 5,000, 10,000 folks, but that can be sustained moving forward. And I think that's another kind of hallmark of Obama's approach to these problems, is he believes it's not a question so much of intervention or non-intervention. It's a question of what's sustainable over time. Going back to 8 years ago, he inherited a situation that was fundamentally unsustainable. We were having success in Iraq with 150,000 troops there. We could not sustain that over time. There was not the political support for it. It was a drain on our resources, and it was breaking the back of our military. Success is not just can you affect an outcome in the moment. How can you affect that outcome over time and sustain it? And I think that's what he's very focused on.
Is part of the difficulty then with the long game, from the Obama administration's point of view, the difficulty in selling a long game of any type to an American public that may not be able to see perhaps more than 4 years down the line in the next election?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's one of the challenges I talk a lot about in the book, is how you try to articulate a long game strategy and implement that strategy in the face of not just crises that pop up every day, but a political atmosphere that, whether you're talking about domestic policy and presidential campaigns or foreign policy, has severe attention deficit disorder, has either further segmented into sound bites. You know, it's not about what are you doing to put us in a position to succeed over the long term. It's how many retweets you can get. And I'm part of that world. I'm not saying I'm an outsider decrying that world. I'm serving the government now, outside the government, trying to get retweets for my interesting comments. So I hope this interview here gets retweeted many times. But that's very hard to do. And I think President Obama's been trying to do it, and he's given many eloquent speeches about America's role in the world and what we should be doing differently, but it's often hard to break through.
It certainly is, but I think two good examples would be where he has broken through, or one at least, the climate change debate.
Sure.
And we have an opening to Cuba. Some may not agree, but I think most would say that the previous policy was quite...
Not working
right. And an anachronism. But one area where he would like to have left a legacy, but probably will not be able to, and I think he deserves a lot of credit, and that is on the issue of trade. Even within his own party, the Democrats have not been on board with the TPP, at least the majority, and or TTIP. These are very progressive, one could argue, visionary policies. Ironically, more Republicans are on board with this type of agenda, but because of their animus toward Obama, it has probably impeded them from embracing that. This is a great irony.
Usually the coalition, the political coalition here in the United States that's cobbled together to pass trade legislation in the Congress, is internationalist Democrats uniting with the majority of Republicans. And unfortunately, there's probably fewer pro-trade internationalist Democrats today, and the Republican Party, for a variety of reasons, whether it's not wanting to do anything for Obama or whether it's their own troubles with trade, that coalition is harder to see. I'm not giving up on TPP personally. I think that the administration will seek to try to get that done later this year in a lame duck Congress. But I think certainly that will be a challenge moving forward, both in TPP, as you mentioned, but also the TTIP, the trade deal with Europe, which is not yet negotiated. Actually, oddly enough, that latter trade deal, the trade deal with Europe, is more controversial right now in Europe than it is in the United States.
The book is The Long Game, How Obama Defied Washington and Redefined America's Role in the World. The author, Derek Sholeh, he's former senior White House, State Department, and Pentagon official. Currently, he's counselor and senior advisor for security and defense policy at the German Marshall Fund. Derek Sholeh, again, congratulations and thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to be here.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Joe Gill. And joining me on the program was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.